I was feeling protective of Natalie and Anne, and my sister's aggressive disrespect raised my hackles. To be honest, I should add that I was also feeling jealous of Emma. Her middle name was Adora. I bet Adora wouldn't be happy to read that her daughter stole items from a tribute to one of her schoolmates, I said.
Schoolmate isn't the same as friend,
said the tall girl, glancing around for confirmation of my stupidity.
Oh, Camille, we're just kidding, Emma said. I feel horrible. They were nice girls. Just weird.
Definitely weird, one of them echoed.
Oh, guys, what if he's killing all the freaks? Emma giggled. Wouldn't that be perfect?
The crying girl looked up at this and smiled. Emma pointedly ignored her.
He?
I asked.
Everyone knows who did it, the husky blonde said.
Natalie's brother. Freaks run in families,
Emma proclaimed.
He's got a little girl thing, the girl called Jodes said sulkily. He's always finding excuses to talk to me, Emma said. At least now I know he won't kill me. Too cool.
She blew an air kiss and handed the teddy to Jodes, looped her arms around the other girls, and with a cheeky, "'Scuse!" bumped past me. Jodes trailed behind. In Emma's snideness, I caught a whiff of desperation and righteousness. Like she'd whined at breakfast, I wish I'd be murdered. Emma didn't want anyone to get more attention than her. Certainly not girls who couldn't compete when they were alive. I phoned Curry near midnight at his home. Curry does a reverse commute, 90 minutes to our suburban office, from the single family his parents left him in Mount Greenwood, a working-class Irish enclave on the south side. He and his wife, Eileen, have no children. Never wanted any, Curry always barks. But I've seen the way he eyes his staffer's toddlers from afar, what close attention he pays when a baby makes a rare appearance in our office. Curry and his wife married late. I guessed they'd been unable to conceive. Eileen is a curvy woman with red hair and freckles that he met at his neighborhood car wash when he was 42. It turned out later on that she was a second cousin of his childhood best friend. They married 3 months to the day they first spoke. Been together for 22 years. I like that Curry likes to tell the story. Eileen was warm when she answered the phone, which was what I needed. Of course they weren't asleep, she laughed. Curry was, in fact, working on one of his puzzles, 4,500 pieces. It had all but taken over the living room, and she had given him 1 week to complete it. I could hear Curry rumble to the phone, could almost smell his tobacco.
Breaker, my girl. What gives? You okay?
I'm okay. There's just not a lot of headway down here. It's taken this long just to get an official police statement.
Which is?
They're looking at everyone.
Pfft, that's crap. There's gotta be more. Find out. You talk to the parents again?
Not yet.
Talk to the parents. If you can't break anything, I want that profile on the dead girls. This is human interest stuff. Not just straight police reporting. Talk to other parents, too. See if they have theories. Ask if they're taking extra precautions. Talk to locksmiths and gun dealers. See if they're getting extra business. Get a clergyman in there or some teachers. Maybe a dentist. See how hard it is to pull out that many teeth. What kind of tool you'd use. Whether you have to have some sort of experience. Talk to some kids. I want voices. I want faces. Give me 30 inches for Sunday. Let's work this while we still have it exclusive.
I took notes first on a legal pad, then in my head, as I began outlining the scars on my right arm with my felt-tip pen.
You mean before there's another murder? Unless the police know a damn lot more than they're giving you. There's gonna be another, yeah. This kind of guy doesn't stop after two. Not when it's this ritualistic.
Curry doesn't know a thing firsthand about ritualistic killings, but he plows through a few low-grade true crimers a week, yellowed paperbacks with glossy covers, he picks up at his used bookstore.
Two for a buck, Preaker. That's what I call entertainment. So, Cubby, any theories on whether it's a local?
Curry seemed to like the nickname for me, his favorite cub reporter. His voice always tickled when he used it, as if the word itself was blushing. I could picture him in the living room, eyeing his puzzle, Eileen taking a quick drag on his cigarette while she stirred up tuna salad with sweet pickles for Curry's lunch. He ate it 3 days a week. Off record, they say yes.
Well, damn it. Get them to say it on record. We need that. That's good.
Here's something strange, Curry. I talked to a boy who says he was with Natalie when she was taken. He said it was a woman.
A woman? It's not a woman. What do the police say?
No comment.
Who's the kid?
Son of a hog worker. Sweet boy. He seems really scared, Curry.
The police don't believe him or you'd have heard about it, right?
I honestly don't know. They're tight here.
Christ, Preaker, break those boys. Get something on record.
Easier said. I kind of feel it's almost a detriment that I'm from here. They resent me carpetbagging back home for this.
Make them like you. You're a likable person. Your mom will vouch for you.
My mom's not so happy I'm here either. Silence. Then a sigh from Curry's end of the line that buzzed my ears. My right arm was a roadmap of deep blue.
You doing okay, Preaker? You taking care of yourself?
I didn't say anything. I suddenly felt like I might cry. I'm okay. This place does bad things to me. I feel wrong.
You keep it together, girl. You're doing real good. You're gonna be fine. And if you feel unfine, call me. I'll get you out.
Okay, Curry.
Eileen says be careful. Hell, I say be careful.
Chapter 6. Small towns usually cater to one kind of drinker. That kind may vary. There are the honky-tonk towns, which keep their bars on the outskirts, make their patrons feel a little bit outlaw. There are the upscale sipping drink towns, with bars that overcharge for a gin Ricky, so the poor people have to drink at home. There are the middle-class strip mall towns, where beers come with onion blossoms and cutely named sandwiches. Luckily, everyone drinks in Wind Gap, so we have all those bars and more. We may be small, but we can drink most towns under the table. The watering hole closest to my mother's home was an expensive, glassy box that specialized in salads and wine spritzers, Wind Gap's sole upscale eatery. It was brunch time, and I couldn't stand the idea of Alan and his soupy eggs, so I walked myself over to La Mer. My French goes only to 11th grade, but judging from the restaurant's aggressively nautical theme, I think the owners meant to name it La Mer, the sea, and not La Mer, the mother. Still, the name was appropriate, as the mother, my mother, frequented this place, as did her friends. They all just love the chicken Caesar, which is neither French nor seafood, but I'm not going to be the one to press the point. Camille! A blonde in a tennis outfit came trotting across the room, glowing with gold necklaces and chunky rings. It was Adora's best friend, Annabelle Gasser, nay Anderson, nicknamed Annie B. It was commonly known that Annabelle absolutely hated her husband's last name. She even crumpled up her nose when she said it. It never occurred to her that she didn't have to take it. Hi, sweetheart. Your mama told me you were in town. Unlike poor Adora-ousted Jackie O'Neill, who I also spotted at the table, looking just as tipsy as she had at the funeral. Annabelle kissed both my cheeks and stepped back to assess me. Still pretty, pretty. Come on. Come sit with us. We're just having a few bottles of wine and gabbin'.
You can lower the age ratio for us.
Annabelle pulled me over to a table where Jackie sat chatting up two more blonde, tanned women. She didn't even stop talking while Annabelle made introductions. She just continued droning about her new bedroom set, then knocked over a glass of water as she jerked back to me.
Camille! You're here! I'm so happy to see you again, sweetie!
She seemed sincere. That juicy fruit smell wafted off her again.
She's been here for 5 minutes, snapped another blonde, wiping the ice and water onto the floor with a swipe of her dark hand. Diamonds flashed from two fingers.
Right, I remember. You're here covering the murders, bad girl, Jackie continued.
Adora must hate that, sleeping in her house with your dirty little brain.
She smiled a smile that must have been saucy 20 years ago. Now it seemed slightly mad.
Jackie, said a blonde, aiming bright saucer eyes at her.
Course, before Adora took it over, we all slept over at Joya's house with our dirty little brains. Same house, different crazy lady running it,
she said to me, fingering the flesh behind her ears. Stitches from that facelift?
You never knew your grandma Joya, did you, Camille?
Purred Annabelle.
Whew! She was a piece of work, sweetie, said Jackie. Scary, scary woman.
How so? I asked. I'd never heard such detail about my grandmother. Adora allowed that she was strict, but said little else.
Oh, Jackie's exaggerating, Annabelle said. No one likes their mother when they're in high school, and Joy was dead pretty soon after. They never really had time to establish an adult relationship.
For a second, I had a pitiful dash of hope that this was why my mother and I were so distant. She had no practice. The idea was dead before Annabelle finished refilling my glass.
Right, Annabelle, Jackie said. I'm sure if Joya were alive today, they'd have a grand old time. At least Joya would. She'd just love to tear at Camille.
Remember those long, long nails of hers? Never painted them. I always thought that was weird.
Change of subject, Annabelle smiled, each word like the tinkle of a silver dinner bell.
I think Camille's job must be so fascinating, said one of the blondes dutifully. Especially this one, said another. Yeah, Camille. Tell us who did it, blurted Jackie.
She smiled leeringly again and clicked her round brown eyes open and shut. She reminded me of a ventriloquist dummy come alive, with hard skin and broken capillaries. I had a few calls to make, but decided this could be better. A quartet of drunk, bored, and bitchy housewives who knew all the gossip of Windgap? I could write it off as a business lunch. Actually, I'd be interested to know what you all think. A sentence they couldn't hear very often. Jackie dipped her bread into a side dish of ranch dressing, then dripped it down her front.
Well, you all know what I think. Anne's daddy, Bob Nash, he's a pervert. He always stares at my chest when I see him at the store.
What chest there is, said Annabelle and nudged me jokingly.
I'm serious. It's out of line. I've been meaning to tell Stephen about it. I've got yummy news, said the fourth blonde.
Dana or Diana? I forgot it as soon as Annabelle introduced us.
Oh, Deanna always has good scoop, Camille, Annabelle said, squeezing my arm.
Deanna paused for effect, licked her teeth, poured herself another glass of wine, and peeked over it at us.
John Keene has moved out of his parents' house, she announced. What? Said a blonde. You are joking, said another. My word, gushed a third.
And, said Deanna triumphantly, smiling like a game show hostess about to bestow a prize.
Into Julie Wheeler's home. The carriage house out back.
That is too good, said Melissa or Melinda.
Oh, you know they're doing it now, laughed Annabel. No way Meredith can keep her little miss perfect thing going. See, Camille? She turned to me. John Keane is Natalie's big brother, and when that family moved here, the whole town went loony for him. I mean, he's gorgeous. He is gorgeous. Julie Wheeler, she's a friend of your mama's and ours, didn't have babies till she was like 30, and when she did, she became just insufferable. One of those people whose kids can do no wrong. So, when Meredith, her daughter, snagged John, oh my God, we thought we'd never hear the end of it. Meredith, this A-student little virgin girl, gets the big man on campus? But no way a boy like that, his age, goes with a girl who isn't putting out. Just doesn't work that way. And now, it's so convenient for them. We should get Polaroids and stick them under Julie's windshield wipers.
Well, you know how she's playing it, Jackie interrupted. It's going to be all about how good they are to take John in and give him a little breathing room while he mourns.
Why is he moving out, though? Asked Melissa Melinda, who I was starting to think was the voice of reason. I mean, shouldn't he be with his folks at a time like this? Why would he need breathing room? Because he's the killer, Deanna blurted, and the table began laughing.
Oh, that would be so delicious if Meredith Wheeler were giving it to some serial killer, Jackie said.
Suddenly the table stopped laughing. Annabel emitted a sneezy hiccup and looked at her watch. Jackie rested her chin on her hand, breathed out hard enough to bluster the breadcrumbs on her plate.
I can't believe this is really happening, said Deanna, looking down at her nails. In our town, where we grew up. Those little girls. It makes me feel sick to my stomach, just sick.
I'm so glad my girls are grown up, Annabel said. I just don't think I'd be able to take it. Poor Adora must be worried sick about Emma.
I nabbed a piece of bread in the birdy, girlish way of my hostesses and steered the conversation away from Adora.
Do people really think John Keane could have had anything to do with it? Or is that just mean gossip?
I could feel myself spitting out the last part. I'd forgotten how unlivable women like these could make Wind Gap for people they didn't like. I ask only because a group of girls, probably junior high schoolers, said the same thing to me yesterday. I thought it best not to mention Emma was one of them.
Let me guess. Four little mouthy blonde things who think they're prettier than they are, Jackie said.
Jackie, sweetheart, do you realize who you just said that to?
Melissa Melinda said, slapping her hand on Jackie's shoulder.
Oh, shit. I always forget Emma and Camille are even related. Different lifetimes, you know?
Jackie smiled. A hearty pop sounded behind her, and she lifted her wine glass without even looking at the waiter.
Camille, you might as well hear it here. Your little Emma is trouble.
I hear they come to all the high school parties, Deanna said, and take all the boys, and do things we didn't do till we were old married women. And then only after the transaction of a few nice pieces of jewelry.
She twirled a diamond tennis bracelet. They all laughed. Jackie actually pounded the table with both fists like a toddler in a fit.
But do... I don't know if people really think John did it. I know the police talked to him, Annabel said. They're definitely a strange family.
Oh, I thought you were close, I said. I saw you at their house after the funeral.
You fucking cunts, I added in my head.
Everybody important in the town of Wind Gap was in that house after the funeral, Deanna said. Like we were going to miss a function like that?
She tried to start the laughter going again, but Jackie and Annabel were nodding solemnly. Melissa Melinda looked around the restaurant as if she could wish herself to another table.
Where's your mama?
Annabelle suddenly blurted. She needs to come down here. Could do her good. She's been acting so strange since this all started.
She was acting strange before this started, too, Jackie said, working her jaw.
I wondered if she was going to vomit.
Oh, please, Jackie.
I'm serious. Camille, let me say this. Right now, way things are with your mother, you're better in Chicago. You should go back soon.
Her face had lost its manicness. She looked completely solemn and genuinely concerned. I felt myself liking her again.
Truly, Camille.
Jackie, shut up,
Annabelle said, and threw a roll hard at Jackie's face. It bounced off her nose and thumped onto the table. A silly flash of violence, like when Dee threw his tennis ball at me. You're less shocked by the impact than the fact it happened at all. Jackie registered the hit with a wave of her hand and kept talking.
I'll say what I please, and I'm saying Adora can harm...
Annabelle stood up and walked over to Jackie's side, pulled her up by her arm.
Jackie, you need to make yourself throw up, she said.
Her voice was a cross between a coup and a threat.
You've had too much to drink, and you're going to feel real sick otherwise. Let me take you to the ladies' room and help make you feel better.
Jackie smacked her hand away at first, but Annabelle's grip tightened, and the two soon tottered away. Silence at the table. My mouth hung open.
That's nothing, Deanna said. We old girls have little fights the same way you young girls do. So, Camille, have you heard we might be getting a gap?
Jackie's words stuck with me. Way things are with your mother, you're better in Chicago. How much more of a sign did I need to leave Wind Gap? I wondered exactly why she and Adora had fallen out. Had to be more than a forgotten greeting card. I made a mental note to drop by Jackie's when she was less looped, if she ever was. Then again, I was hardly the one to frown on a drinker. Sailing on a nice wine buzz, I called the Nashes from the convenience store, and a quivering girl's voice said hello and then went silent. I could hear breathing, but no answer to my requests to speak with Mom or Dad. Then a slow, sliding click before the line went dead. I decided to try my luck in person. A boxy disco-era minivan sat in the Nash driveway next to a rusty yellow Trans Am, which I assumed meant both Bob and Betsy were home. The eldest daughter answered the bell, but simply stood inside the screen door staring at my stomach when I asked if her folks were home. The Nashes were built tiny. This one, Ashley, I knew was 12, but like the pudgy boy I'd met on my first visit, she looked several years younger than her age, and acted it. She sucked on her hair and hardly blinked when little Bobby waddled next to her and began crying at the sight of me, then howling. A good minute went by before Betsy Nash came to the door. She looked as dazed as both her children and seemed confused when I introduced myself.
Wind Gap don't have a local daily paper, she said.
Right. I'm from the Chicago Daily Post, I said. Up in Chicago? Illinois?
Well, my husband deals with purchases like that, she said, and began running her fingers through her son's blonde hair.
I'm not selling a subscription or anything. Is Mr. Nash home? Maybe I could just chat with him real quick. All three Nashes moved away from the door en masse, and after another few minutes, Bob Nash had me ushered inside and was throwing laundry off the couch to make room for me to sit.
God damn it, this place is a pit, he muttered loudly toward his wife. I apologize for the state of our home, Miss Preaker. Things have kind of gone to hell ever since Anne.
Oh, don't worry about it at all, I said, pulling a pair of tiny boys' undies from beneath me. This is what my place looks like all the time. This was the opposite of true.
One quality I did inherit from my mother was a compulsive neatness. I have to stop myself from ironing socks. When I got back from the hospital, I even went through a period of boiling things. Tweezers and eyelash curlers, bobby pins and toothbrushes. It was an indulgence I allowed myself. I ended up trashing the tweezers, though. Too many late-night thoughts about their shiny, warm points. Dirty girl, indeed. I was hoping Betsy Nash would disappear, literally. She was so insubstantial, I could imagine her slowly evaporating, leaving only a sticky spot on the edge of the sofa. But she lingered, eyes darting between me and her husband before we even began speaking, like she was winding up for the conversation. The children, too, hovered about, little blonde ghosts trapped in a limbo between indolence and stupidity. The pretty girl might do all right, but the piggy middle child, who now waddled dazedly into the room, was destined for needy sex and snack cake binging. The boy was the type who'd end up drinking in gas station parking lots, the kind of angry, bored kid I saw on my way into town. "Mr. Nash, I need to speak some more with you about Anne, for a larger piece," I started. "You've been very kind with your time, and I was hoping to get a little bit more."
"Anything that might get this case a little attention, we don't mind," he said. "What do you need to know?"
"What kind of games did she like? What kind of foods did she like? What would be some words you'd use to describe her? Did she tend to be a ringleader or a follower? Did she have lots of friends or just a few close ones? How did she like school? What did she do on her Saturdays?" The Nashes stared at me in silence for a second. "Just for starters," I smiled.
"My wife would be the one to answer most of those questions," Bob Nash said. "She's the caregiver."
He turned to Betsy Nash, who was folding and refolding the same dress on her lap.
"She liked pizza and fish sticks," she said. "And she had lots of girls she was friendly with, but only a few close friends, if you know what I mean. She played by herself a lot."
"Look, Mommy, Barbie needs clothes," said Ashley, wielding a naked plastic doll in front of her mother's face.
All three of us ignored her, and she tossed the toy to the floor and began twirling around the room in fake ballerina moves. Seeing a rare chance, Tiffany pounced on the Barbie and began splaying the rubbery tan legs open and shut, open and shut.
"She was tough. She was my toughest," Bob Nash said. "She could have played football if she'd been a boy. She'd knock herself silly just running around. Always had scrapes and bruises."
"Anne was my mouth," Betsy said quietly. Then she said no more. "How is that, Mrs. Nash?"
"She was a real talker. Said whatever come into her mind. In a good way, mostly."
She was silent again for a few beats, but I could see her thinking back behind her eyes, so I said nothing.
"You know, I thought maybe she'd be a lawyer or college debater or something someday, because she was just... She never stopped to measure her words, like me. I think everything I say is stupid. Anne thought everyone should hear everything she had to say."
"You mentioned school, Miss Preaker," interrupted Bob Nash. "That's where her talkativeness got her in trouble. She could be a little bossy, and we got a few calls from her teachers over the years about her not taking too well to class. She was a little wild."
"But sometimes I think it was because she was just so smart," added Betsy Nash.
"She was whip smart, yep," Bob Nash nodded. "Sometimes I thought she was smarter than her old man. Sometimes she thought she was smarter than her old man."
"Look at me, Mommy."
Piggy Tiffany, who had been chewing mindlessly on Barbie's toes, ran to the center of the living room and began doing somersaults. Ashley, seized by some phantom anger, yelped at the sight of her mother's attention on the second daughter and gave her a hard shove, then yanked her hair emphatically once.
Tiffany's face split in a red wail, which started Bobby Jr. crying again.
It's Tiffany's fault,
Ashley screamed and began whimpering also. I had shattered some delicate dynamic. A multi-child household is a pit of petty jealousies, this I knew, and the Nash children were panicking at the idea of competing not just with one another, but with a dead sister. They had my sympathies.
Betsy, muttered Bob Nash quietly, eyebrows slightly raised.
Bobby Jr. was quickly scooped up and propped on a hip. Tiffany pulled up from the floor with one hand, another arm around the now inconsolable Ashley, and soon the four were moving out of the room. Bob Nash stared after them a beat.
Been like that for almost a year now, those girls, he said. Them acting like little babies. Thought they were supposed to be anxious to grow up. And being gone changes this home more than...
He shifted on the sofa.
It's just that she was a real person, you know? You think, 9 years old, what's that? What's there? But Anne had a personality. I could guess what she'd think about things. I knew when we were watching TV what stuff she'd think was funny and what stuff she'd think was dumb.
I can't do that with my other kids.
Hell, I can't do that with my wife. Anne, you just felt her there. I just...
Bob Nash's throat shut up on him. He stood and turned away from me. Turned back once, then away. Walked in a circle behind the couch, then stood in front of me.
God damn it, I want her back. I mean, what now? Is this it?
He threw his hand around the room toward the doorway where his wife and kids had exited.
Because if this is it, there ain't much point, is there? And God damn it, someone needs to find that man because he needs to tell me. Why, Anne? I need to know that. She was the one I'd always thought would do okay.
I sat quiet for a second, could feel my pulse in my neck. Mr. Nash, it has been suggested to me that maybe Anne's personality, which you mentioned was very strong, might have rubbed some people the wrong way. Do you think that could have anything to do with this? I could feel him get wary on me, see it in the way he sat down and deliberately leaned back onto the couch, spread his arms and pretended to be casual.
Rubbed who the wrong way?
Well, I understand there were troubles about Anne and a neighbor's bird, that she may have hurt a neighbor's bird. Bob Nash rubbed his eyes, looked at his feet.
God, people gossip in this town. No one ever proved Anne did that. She and the neighbors already had bad blood. Joe Duke across the way. His girls, they're older, they messed with Anne a lot, teased her a lot. Then they have her over to play one day. I don't really know what happened, but by the time Anne got back here, they were all screaming that she'd killed their goddamn bird.
He laughed, shrugged his shoulders.
Be fine by me if she had. It was a noisy old thing.
Do you think Anne would be likely to do something like that if provoked?
Well, it was a fool who provoked Anne, he said. She didn't take that kind of thing well. She wasn't exactly a little lady.
Do you think she knew the person who killed her? Nash picked up a pink T-shirt from the sofa, folded it in squares like a kerchief.
Used to think no. Now I think yes. I think she went with someone she knew.
Would she be more likely to go with a man or a woman? I asked.
So, you heard the James Capisci story?
I nodded.
Well, a little girl is more likely to trust a person who reminds her of her mama, right?
Depends on what her mama's like, I thought.
But I still think it's a man. Can't picture a woman doing all that to a baby. I hear John Keene has no alibi. Maybe he wanted to kill a little girl. Saw Natalie all day every day and couldn't take it, the urge,
So he went out and killed another little tomboy. Girl kind of liked Natalie. But then in the end, he couldn't resist, took Natalie too.
Is that the talk? I asked.
Some of it, I suppose.
Betsy Nash appeared suddenly in the doorway. Looking down at her knees, she said,
Bob, Adora is here.
My stomach clenched without my permission. My mother breezed in, smelling like bright blue water. She looked more comfortable in the Nash house than Mrs. Nash did. It was a natural gift for Adora, making other women feel incidental. Betsy Nash retired from the room like some maid from a 1930s movie. My mother refused to look at me, but went straight to Bob Nash.
Bob, Betsy told me there was a reporter here, and I knew right then it was my daughter. I'm so sorry. I can't apologize enough for the intrusion.
Bob Nash stared at Adora, then at me.
This is your daughter? I had no idea.
No, probably not. Camille's not the family type.
Why didn't you say anything?
Nash asked me.
I told you I was from Windgap. I had no idea you'd be interested in who my mother was.
Oh, I'm not angry, don't get me wrong. It's just that your mother is a very good friend to us,
he said, as if she were some big-hearted patron. She tutored Anne in English and spelling. Your mother and Anne were very close. Anne was very proud she had an adult friend. My mother sat with her hands folded in her lap, skirts spread out along the couch, and blinked at me. I felt as if I were being warned not to say something, but I didn't know what.
I had no idea, I finally said. True. I'd thought my mother was overplaying her mourning, pretending to know those girls. Now I was surprised at how subtle she'd been. But why in the world was she tutoring Anne? She'd done the mother's aid thing at my school when I was a kid, mainly to spend time with other Windgap housewives, but I couldn't picture her noblesse oblige extending to spending afternoons with an unkempt girl from the west side of town. Occasionally, I underestimated Adora, I suppose.
Camille, I think you should leave, Adora said. I'm here on a social visit, and it's difficult for me to relax around you these days.
I'm not quite done talking with Mr. Nash.
Yes, you are.
Adora looked at Nash for confirmation, and he smiled awkwardly, like someone staring down the sun.
Maybe we can pick this up later, Miss...
Camille. A word suddenly flashed on my lower hip. Punish. I could feel it getting hot.
Thanks for your time, Mr. Nash, I said, and strode out of the room, not looking at my mother. I began crying before I'd even reached my car.
Chapter 7. Once I was standing on a cold corner in Chicago waiting for the light to change, when a blind man came clicking up. What are the cross streets here? He asked. And when I didn't reply, he turned toward me and said, Is anybody there? I'm here, I said. And it felt shockingly comforting, those words. When I'm panicked, I say them aloud to myself. I'm here. I don't usually feel that I am. I feel like a warm gust of wind could exhale my way, and I'd be disappeared forever, not even a sliver of fingernail left behind. On some days, I find this thought calming. On others, it chills me. My sense of weightlessness, I think, comes from the fact that I know so little about my past. Or at least that's what the shrinks at the clinic came up with. I've long since given up trying to discover anything about my dad. When I picture him, it's as a generic father image. I can't stand to think about him too specifically, to imagine him shopping for groceries or having a cup of morning coffee, coming home to kids. Will I someday run smack into a girl who looks like me? As a child, I struggled to find a solid resemblance between my mother and myself,
some link that would prove I came from her. I'd study her when she wasn't looking, steal the framed portraits from her room, and try to convince myself I had her eyes. Or maybe it was something not in the face, the turn of a calf or the hollow of my neck. She never even told me how she'd met Alan. What I know of their story has come from other people. Questions are discouraged, considered prying. I remember the shock of hearing my college roommate talk to her mother on the phone. The detailed minutiae, her lack of censorship seemed decadent. She would say silly things, like how she forgot she'd enrolled for a class, completely forgot she was supposed to be in Geography 101 3 days a week, and she'd say it in the same boastful tone of a kindergartner with a gold star crayon drawing. I remember finally meeting her mom, how she zipped around our suite, asking so many questions, knowing already so much about me. She gave Allison a big plastic bag of safety pins that she thought might come in handy, and when they left for lunch, I surprised myself by bursting into tears. The gesture, so random and kind, baffled me. Is this what mothers did? Wonder if you might need safety pins? Mine phoned once a month and always asked the same practical questions. Grades, classes, upcoming expenses. As a child, I don't remember ever telling Adora my favorite color or what I'd like to name my daughter when I grew up. I don't think she ever knew my favorite dish, and I certainly never padded down to her room in the early morning hours, teary from nightmares. I always feel sad for the girl that I was, because it never occurred to me that my mother might comfort me. She has never told me she loved me, and I never assumed she did. She tended to me. She administrated me. Oh, yes, and one time she bought me lotion with vitamin E. For a while I convinced myself that Adora's distance was a defense constructed after Marion. But in truth, I think she's always had more problems with children than she'd ever admit. I think, in fact, she hates them. There's a jealousy, a resentfulness that I can feel even now in my memory. At one point, she probably liked the idea of a daughter. When she was a girl, I bet she daydreamed of being a mother, of coddling, of licking her child like a milk-swelled cat. She has that voraciousness about children. She swoops in on them. Even I, in public, was a beloved child. Once her period of mourning for Marion was over, she'd parade me into town, smiling and teasing me, tickling me as she spoke with people on the sidewalks. When we got home, she'd trail off to her room like an unfinished sentence, and I would sit outside with my face pressed against her door and replay the day in my head, searching for clues to what I'd done to displease her. I have one memory that catches in me like a nasty clump of blood. Marion was dead about 2 years, and my mother had a cluster of friends come over for afternoon drinks. One of them brought a baby. For hours, the child was cooed over, smothered with red lipstick kisses, tidied up with tissues, then lipstick smacked again. I was supposed to be reading in my room, but I sat at the top of the stairs watching. My mother finally was handed the baby, and she cuddled it ferociously. Oh, how wonderful it is to hold a baby again! Adora jiggled it on her knee, walked it around the rooms, whispered to it, and I looked down from above like a spiteful little god, the back of my hand placed against my face, imagining how it felt to be cheek to cheek with my mother. When the ladies went into the kitchen to help tidy up the dishes, something changed. I remember my mother, alone in the living room, staring at the child almost lasciviously. She pressed her lips hard against the baby's apple slice of a cheek. Then she opened her mouth just slightly, took a tiny bit of flesh between her teeth, and gave it a little bite. The baby wailed. The blotch faded as Adora snuggled the child and told the other women it was just being fussy. I ran to Marion's room and got under the covers.
back at Foothes for a drink after my mother and the Nashes. I was boozing too much, but never to the point of drunkenness, I reasoned with myself. I needed just a nip. I've always been partial to the image of liquor as lubrication, a layer of protection from all the sharp thoughts in your head. The barkeep was a round-faced guy, two classes behind me, who I was pretty sure was named Barry, but not sure enough to actually call him that. He muttered, "Welcome back," as he filled my big-mouth cup two-thirds full of bourbon, splashed some Coke on top. "On the house," he said to the napkin holder. "We don't take money from pretty women here." His neck shot red, and he suddenly pretended he had urgent business at the other end of the counter. I took Neho Drive on the way back to the house. It was a street several of my friends had lived on, slicing through town and growing increasingly more posh as it neared Adora's. I spotted Katie Lacey's old home, a flimsy mansion her parents built when we were 10, after they'd smashed their old Victorian into shards. A block ahead of me, a little girl on a golf cart decorated with flower stickers putt-putted along. She wore her hair in elaborate braids like a little Swiss maid on a cocoa box. Emma. She'd taken advantage of Adora's visit to the Nashes to make an escape. Girls traveling solo were an oddity in Wind Gap since Natalie's killing. Rather than continue home, she turned and headed east, which meant dirt box houses and the pig farm. I turned the corner and followed her so slowly I almost stalled out. The route offered a nice downhill slope for Emma, and the cart glided so fast her braids flew out behind her. In 10 minutes, we were in the country. Tall yellow grasses and bored cows. Barns leaning like old men. I let the car idle for a few minutes to give Emma a good head start, then drove just far enough to keep her in sight. I trailed her past farmhouses and a roadside walnut stand that was manned by a boy who held his cigarette jaunty as a movie star. Soon the air smelled like shit and stale saliva, and I knew where we were heading. Another 10 minutes and the metal pig holds came into sight, long and glinty like rows of staples. The squeals made my ears sweat, like screams from a rusty well pump. My nose flared involuntarily and my eyes started watering. You ever been near an animal processing plant, you know what I mean. The smell isn't like water or air. It's a solid. Like you should be able to cut a hole in the stink to get some relief. You can't. Emma zipped through the gates of the plant. The guy at the booth just waved at her. I had a tougher time until I said the magic word. Adora.
Right. Adora's got a grown-up daughter. I remember, said the old guy.
His name tag said Jose. I tried to see if he was missing any fingers. Mexicans don't get cushy box jobs unless they're owed. That's the way plants down here work. The Mexicans get the shittiest, most dangerous jobs, and the whites still complain. Emma parked her cart next to a pickup and dusted herself off. Then, with a businesslike beeline, she walked straight past the slaughtering house, past the lines of pig holds, those wet pink snouts squirming between the air slats, and to a big metal barn of a building where the nursing happens. Most sows are repeatedly inseminated, brood after brood, till their bodies give way and they go to slaughter. But while they're still useful, they're made to nurse. Strapped to their sides in a farrowing crate, legs apart, nipples exposed. Pigs are extremely smart, sociable creatures, and this forced assembly line intimacy makes the nursing sows want to die, which, as soon as they dry up, they do. Even the idea of this practice I find repulsive, but the sight of it actually does something to you. Makes you less human. Like watching a rape and saying nothing. I saw Emma at the far end of the barn, standing at the edge of one metal farrowing crate.
A few men were pulling one pack of squealing piglets out of the stall, throwing another pack in. I moved to the far side of the barn so I could stand behind Emma without her seeing me. The pig lay nearly comatose on its side, its belly exposed between metal bars, red, bloody nipples pointing out like fingers. One of the men rubbed oil on the goriest one, then flicked it and giggled. They paid no attention to Emma, as if it were quite normal that she was there. She winked at one as they snapped another sow and a crate and drove off to get the next pack. The piglets in the stall were swarming over the sow like ants on a glob of jelly. The nipples were fought over, bouncing in and out of mouths, jiggling tautly like rubber. The sow's eyes rolled up into her head. Emma sat down cross-legged and gazed, fascinated. After 5 minutes she was in the same position, now smiling and squirming. I had to leave. I walked first slowly, then broke into a scramble to my car. Door shut, radio blasting, warm bourbon stinging my throat, I drove away from the stink and sound. And that child. Chapter 8 Emma. All this time I'd had little real interest in her. Now I did. What I saw at the farm kept my throat clenched. My mother said she was the most popular girl in school, and I believed it. Jackie said she was the meanest, and I believed that, too. Living in the swirl of Adora's bitterness had to make one a bit crooked. And what did Emma make of Marion, I wondered? How confusing to live in the shadow of a shadow. But Emma was a smart girl. She did her acting out away from home. Near Adora, she was compliant, sweet, needy, just what she had to be to get my mother's love. But that violent streak, the tantrum, the smacking of her friend, and now this ugliness. A penchant for doing and seeing nasty things. It suddenly reminded me of the stories about Anne and Natalie. Emma wasn't like Marion, but maybe she was a little bit like them. It was late afternoon, just before supper time, and I decided to make a second pass at the Keens. I needed a quote for my feature piece, and if I couldn't get it, Curry was going to pull me out. Leaving Windgap would cause me no pain personally, but I needed to prove I could handle myself, especially with my credibility faltering. A girl who slices herself open isn't the first on the list for tough assignments. I drove past the spot where Natalie's body was discovered. What Emma deemed unworthy of stealing sat in a sad clump. 3 stumpy candles, long since blown out, along with cheap flowers still in their supermarket wrappers. A limp helium balloon in the shape of a heart bobbing listlessly. In the driveway outside the Keen home, Natalie's brother sat in the passenger seat of a red convertible, talking with a blonde girl who almost matched his beauty. I parked behind them, saw them sneak quick looks, then pretend not to notice me. The girl began laughing animatedly, weaving her red lacquered nails through the back of the boy's dark hair. I gave them a quick, awkward nod, which I'm sure they didn't see, and slipped past them to the front door. Natalie's mother answered. Behind her, the house was dark and quiet. Her face stayed open. She didn't recognize me. "Mrs. Keen, I am so sorry to bother you at a time like this, but I really need to talk with you." "About Natalie?" "Yes. May I come in?" It was a nasty trick to sneak my way into her home without identifying myself. Reporters are like vampires, Curry likes to say. They can't come into your home without your invitation, but once they're there, you won't get them out till they've sucked you dry. She opened the door. "Oh, it feels nice and cool in here, thanks," I said. "It was supposed to peak at 90 today, but I think we passed that." "I heard 95. "I believe it. Could I trouble you for a glass of water?" another time-honored ploy. A woman is less likely to throw you out if she's offered her hospitality. If you have allergies or a cold, asking for a tissue is even better. Women love vulnerability. Most women.
Of course.
She paused, looking at me, as if she felt she should know who I was and was too embarrassed to ask. Morticians, priests, police, medics, mourners. She'd probably met more people in the past few days than she had the previous year. While Mrs. Keene disappeared into the kitchen, I peered around. The room looked completely different today, with furniture moved back into the proper places. On a table not far away sat a photo of the two Keene children. They were each leaning on the side of a big oak tree, dressed in jeans and red sweaters. He was smiling uncomfortably, like he was doing something best left undocumented. She was maybe half his height and looked determinedly serious, like the subject of an old daguerreotype.
"What's your son's name?"
"That's John. He's a very kind, gentle boy. I've always been proudest of that. He just graduated from high school." "They bumped it up a little. When I went to school here, they made us wait till June." Nice to have the longer summers." I smiled. She smiled. I sat down and sipped my water. I couldn't remember what Curry advised once you tricked your way into someone's living room. "We actually haven't properly met. I'm Camille Preaker, from the Chicago Daily Post. We spoke briefly on the phone the other night." She stopped smiling. Her jaw started working.
"You should have said that before."
"I know what a horrible time this is for you, and if I could just ask you a few questions..."
"You may not."
"Mrs. Keene, we want to be fair to your family. That's why I'm here. The more information we can give people,
the more papers you can sell." "I'm sick and tired of all this. Now I will tell you one last time. Do not come back here. Do not try to contact us. I have absolutely nothing to say to you."
She stood over me, leaned down. She wore, as she had at the funeral, a beaded necklace made of wood with a big red heart at its center. It bobbed back and forth off her bosom like a hypnotist's watch.
"I think you are a parasite," she spat at me. "I think you are disgusting. I hope someday you look back and see how ugly you are. Now please leave."
She trailed me to the door, as if she wouldn't believe I was truly gone until she saw me step outside her home. She closed the door behind me with enough force to make her doorbell chime lightly. I stood on the stoop blushing, thinking to myself what a nice detail that heart necklace would make in my story, and saw the girl in the red convertible staring at me. The boy was gone.
"You're Camille Preaker, right?"
she called out.
"Yes." "I remember you," the girl said. "I was just a little thing when you lived here, but we all knew you."
"What's your name?"
"Meredith Wheeler."
"You wouldn't remember me. I was just a little goofball when you were in high school." John Keene's girlfriend. Her name was familiar, thanks to my mother's friends, but I wouldn't have remembered her personally. Hell, she'd have been all of 6 or 7 last time I lived here. Still, I wasn't surprised she knew me. Girls growing up in Wind Gap studied the older girls obsessively. Who dated the football stars? Who was homecoming queen? Who mattered? You traded favorites like baseball cards. I still remember Cece Wyatt, Calhoun High prom queen from when I was a girl. I once bought 11 drugstore lipsticks, trying to find the exact shade of pink she wore when she said hello to me one morning.
"I remember you," I said. "I can't believe you're driving."
She laughed, seemed pleased by my lie.
"You're a reporter now, right?"
"Yes, in Chicago."
"I'll get John to talk to you. We'll be in touch."
Meredith zipped away. I'm sure she felt quite pleased with herself.
"We'll be in touch,"
reapplying her lip gloss and thinking not at all of the dead 10-year-old that was to be the subject of conversation. I phoned the main hardware store in town, the one where Natalie's body had been